Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have a very special guest. His name is Troy Zuccolato, and Troy was the overall winner at the 1989 NPC Nationals, so we're going back 30 years. And Troy also had a really good amateur career. He was competing in many of the contests in the 1980s, took a real close second place to John DeFendis at the 1988 NPC USA. And he was one of the most popular bodybuilders back then. Troy was about 6 feet tall, 240, blonde hair, had that spiked blonde hair that was very popular in the 1980s, kind of the Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator cut. He was blonde, blue eyes, and real popular with Joe Weider. He was featured a lot in the magazines. He looked very much like the California bodybuilder. So Troy finally got his pro card at the 1989 NPC Nationals, and then he spent some time competing in the WBF with Vince McMahon. And what's also interesting about Troy is he kind of retired early. He didn't spend a lot of time as a pro, but he's very, very successful as a businessman. He started one of the very first HRT clinics out in California in very rich areas of the state, and he made a lot of money, and now he is investing in other things. So we got some time during the interview to ask him about his other business ventures, which I thought was very impressive and pretty remarkable too when you think about how many bodybuilders really make it big in business, and Troy is one of the few, and he's very, very successful. So we're going to be talking to Troy Zuccolato in a minute. Before we get to our interview with Troy, I want to mention our sponsor, Old School Labs. I have been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. It's the brand I used to win the Natural Mr. Universe in 2012. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn. It's the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner, or Vintage Blast, which is their two-stage pre-workout, or Vintage Brawn, which is the triple protein isolate powerhouse that's packed with eggs, milk, and beef protein. Their products have no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. Old School Labs is also the home of 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banut and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will receive 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. And after our interview with Troy, I want you guys to stick around. I'm going to read another article this week. This one is really interesting. It's from the March 1985 issue of Muscle Mag International, and it is the 1984 Mr. Olympia report, which was written by Greg Zulak from Muscle Mag International. And, of course, this was Lee Haney's first Mr. Olympia win, his first out of 8 wins, and it was really a spectacular contest. This has to be one of the best Mr. Olympias in the history of the sport, because not only did we have Lee Haney win his first Olympia, but there was just so many bodybuilding champions from the 70s and the 80s competing on that stage. And of course, the most famous was Sergio Oliva, 3-time Mr. Olympia, who was making his comeback. I think Sergio was about in his mid-40s. He won, of course, 3 Mr. Olympias from 1967 through 69. He had some great battles with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And a lot of people felt like if Sergio came into this contest in the same condition that he was in 1972 when he took second to Arnold at the Mr. Olympia, and a lot of people thought he should have won, they thought that he would clean up and he would win. So it's a really interesting article, and it's very long, but it's very detailed. It's really, really interesting. So you guys are going to love it. If you don't know much about the 1984 Olympia, or if you were around during that time and you do remember it, you're going to stick around and hear this article from Greg Zulak from Muscle Mag International. It's going to be really great. All right. And unfortunately, we've got some bad news to pass on this week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We had another legend pass away this last week, and it was on November 19th. Joseph Wilkosch, one of the great bodybuilders from the 1980s, passed away. He was 71 years old. He was born in 1948. Those of you who were around during that time, as I was, will remember Joseph. He was one of the most impressive bodybuilders on the scene during that time. Joseph took second to Mike Mentzer at the 1978 Mr. Universe contest that was held in Acapulco. This was the contest where Mike Mentzer got a perfect score, and Joseph Wilkosch sort of made his big debut at that contest, and a lot of people were wondering who this guy was. Joseph was from Germany. He was about 6 feet tall, and he weighed anywhere from like 230 to 240 pounds, so he was a really big guy for that time. Part of what set Joseph apart was he had this full beard that he wore his whole contest career, and it sort of made him look very stoic and very serious on stage. He didn't smile a lot. He didn't have a lot of the charisma that a Muhammad McAway would have or Chris Dickerson, but that was Joseph's style, and he just had his own persona, and he was very, very impressive looking, and he's also very, very hard. He was one of the hardest bodybuilders who competed, and in this article that I'm going to read later on in the podcast about the 1984 Olympia, Joseph took third place in that contest. That was his highest placing in the Mr. Olympia. And I think Joseph tied Dennis Wolf with the highest placing that a German bodybuilder ever took in the Mr. Olympia, because Dennis Wolf also got third place 1 year. So anyways, Joseph went on after that loss to Mike Mentzer. He went on to win the Mr. Universe the following year in 1979 when it was held in Columbus, Ohio. And I saw that contest because I was in Columbus that year. And Joseph won the heavyweight class at the Mr. Universe. He beat out Ray Mentzer, who was Mike's brother. And that was the best Ray ever looked, because Ray won the Mr. America that year, and he really reached peak condition. I don't think he was quite as peak condition at the Universe as he was at the America, but Joseph was a convincing winner. I was there. I saw that show. The following year, Joseph trained with Arnold when Arnold was getting ready for the Mr. Olympia. So there's a lot of pictures online. There was a lot of pictures in the magazines at the time of Arnold and Joseph training together as Arnold was getting ready for the Mr. Olympia and Joseph was preparing for the Pro Mr. Universe, which Arnold also promoted, and that was in Columbus, Ohio. So in 1980, the Mr. Olympia, which Arnold and Jim Lorimer had been promoting since 1976, that moved over to Australia in Sydney. And Paul Graham was promoting it that year. And, of course, Arnold won that contest, one of the most controversial, if not the most controversial Mr. Olympias ever. And Arnold and Jim, about a month later or a couple weeks later, they promoted the Pro Mr. Universe in Columbus, Ohio, along with the Mr. International. And Joseph was the winner of that Pro Mr. Universe, and he beat out Tom Platz, who looked really, really good. So after that, Joseph was a professional. Well, actually, he was a professional after winning the Universe, so that was his first pro win. And then he started going into the Mr. Olympia. He competed in the Mr. Olympia in 81 when Franco won, and Joseph was in sixth place. He looked pretty good there. And then the following year, in 1982, I think he dropped down to 10th place when Chris Dickerson won. But in 1983, he was much bigger and looked much better, and he took sixth place. And that was the year, of course, that Samir Banute won. And then 1984 was his biggest placing ever, where he took third place at the Mr. Olympia. And I believe Joseph might have did some master shows too later in his career, but he was a really, really good friend of Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he was a great bodybuilder and one of our real legends of the sport. So this has really been a tough year for bodybuilding. Of course, we lost Ed Corney on January 1st, and then we lost Franco Colombo in August, and now we've lost Joseph Wilkosch just shortly after his 71st birthday, because he was born in November. So very, very tough year for bodybuilding, and rest in peace, Joseph, and all the best to his family and his friends. I know Sven Ole Thorsen also posted something on Facebook about losing a good friend, because he was good friends with Joseph also. And they were also, of course, really good friends, both of them, with Arnold Schwarzenegger. All right. Before we get to our interview with Troy Zuccolato, I want to read some of the emails we got from the Dale Ruplinger interview last week, which was very well received. They got a lot of good feedback, including the guys from Bodybuilding Nerds Radio, VJ and Scott. Thank you very much for talking about the show. They talked about it at length, so that was really cool. I guess VJ actually met Dale Ruplinger because VJ is from Iowa, so that was cool. So I actually sent a copy of the Bodybuilding Nerds Radio podcast to Dale Ruplinger because I told him to listen to it at this point in the show where they talked about the interview I did with him for the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. So anyways, on my Facebook page, Sherry Myers said, awesome. We need more exposure on bodybuilding. I wonder if all the greats will show for the 2020 Olympia. That would be a phenomenal show. That wasn't anything about Dale Ruplinger. But Vince Taylor made a comment, and he said, great pick of Dale Ruplinger. Really awesome dude, Dale Ruplinger. Andy Hammond said, one of the best. I think top 10 of all time. Thomas Hintz, killer. I used to know Tom from Hammer's Gym when we trained him when I was younger, back in the 80s. And Tom said, I met him when I trained at DePepe's gym in Quad Cities. He always competed in contests prepared. He was always ripped. And then Brian Dunham said, very insightful interview. And on my Bodybuilding Legends page on Facebook, I also got some comments. Mark Kretz said, the man with the hollow bones. And, of course, that was the nickname given to Dale by Mike Mentzer because they couldn't believe how big he was for being only a middleweight. Eric Burke said, that was a great interview. You could tell how passionate Dale was and is about bodybuilding. I wasn't familiar with him, so I Googled his pics when I got home. And wow, what a thick physique. And then it was funny because Eric posted a picture of Dale, and I think this was from the guest posing Dale did the week before he competed in the Night of the Champions in 1986, where he weighed 230 pounds. And some guy said, Eric, that picture is Photoshopped. And Eric replied, it's from his Facebook page, so I don't think it is. So that's so crazy that Dale was so big. He was so huge. People thought it was actually Photoshopped. And then David replied again. He goes, John and Eric, I never saw pictures of him looking that way, so that's why I thought it was Photoshopped. I hope there are more pictures. I haven't heard the interview yet, and I'm looking forward to it. All right, and Ed Castillo on my johnhansonfitness.com page on Facebook said, tell Dale I said hello from the Quad Cities area. Pat Comer said, great interview, John. Michael Dusa said, hollow bones. Jeff Geldine said, all I want to know is how Dale came in looking like a 2019 bodybuilder in 1986. And I also got a long message from Randy Christ, and Randy is another listener to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. He had a great letter here. He said, hey, John, great interview with Dale Ruplinger. I just wanted to share some things that I witnessed in regards to the USA weekend in 1982, where Dale won the overall. He said, I was born and raised Southern Californian. And in the early 1980s, I trained at an amazing gym in Orange County, Needham's Gym. Being 20 years old, it was amazing seeing John Brown and Rod Koontz on a daily basis, and then later seeing a young Sean Ray. I remember I met two young bodybuilders from Quad Cities in 1982. These guys had trained at Joe's Gym, where Dale trained. He later bought the gym, and he called it Mr. Universe Gym. One of those friends was Tom Koopman, who won the Mr. Iowa the year after Dale and placed fourth in the heavyweights at the Mr. Midwest. And then the other friend was Gail Ugart, who resembled Matt Mendenhall. These two guys were telling me that we had to go to the USA in Vegas because their buddy Dale was going to compete. I was all in, as I'd never been to a national level show before. We made our way to Caesar's Palace for Friday's prejudging. My two friends are yelling Ruplinger as we walked into the ballroom. They grabbed Dale and introduced me to him. He was wearing a warm-up suit, and he looked very small, to be honest. I wasn't really impressed. Tom asked Dale to show me his legs. He bent over and pulled his pants down. Oh, my God, I will never forget those amazing quads. The veins were like spider webs. At prejudging, people were asking us who Ruplinger was. Just wait, we told them. As they lined up on stage, it was clear that Dale was shredded, but some other guys looked good. When they turned around to the back, it was over. Dale was the only middleweight with a complete back. We witnessed his amazing prejudging performance, and then we sat Saturday night hoping he'd take the class, which he did. The heavyweight class ignored Mike Christian, who looked fantastic, and he gave the class to John Jordan. Who? Dale easily won the overall as he was being interviewed and later taken for a photo shoot. He gave me his bag. He gave Guy his middleweight trophy and Tom his overall trophy. It had to be 6 feet tall to take up to his room. Here's the real interesting stuff. Sorry the background information was so long. The three of us joined Dale and his cousin, who was a chiropractor, on a fun Vegas night. We went to a strip club, and the MC looked at us and said, you guys must be here for the bodybuilding show. We said yes, and we have the winner with us. They grabbed Dale, who was still in his warm-ups and posing trunks, and had him pose on stage with a few girls. After that, we went to the MGM Grand so Dale could get some apple pie a la mode. Dale told us a few interesting things while we watched him devour his pie. He told us how he had cheated on his diet a few times during his prep with ice cream. He stated that he would eat his normal scheduled meal, and then he would eat a pint of ice cream. He would go to the bathroom, stick his finger down his throat, and vomit up the ice cream, stopping when his meal started coming up. He said as it got closer to the show, he could do it without using his finger. Yuck. But who ever heard of bulimia in 1982? He also stated that he was one of the very few bodybuilders that could get cut using Dianabol. We walked around the strip for a while, as I was with a pack of Midwesterners who had never seen Vegas. The night concluded with Dale stopping traffic on the strip. How? The hookers found out he was Mr. USA, and they had him stripped down to his posing trunks, hitting poses on the street corner to be surrounded by at least 10 hookers at 5 a.m. I know that was a long story. I hope you enjoyed the little extra. Keep up the good work, John. I'm loving this stuff during my cardio sessions. All right, Randy, that was great. Great story. All right, before we get to our interview with Troy Zuccolato, I want to mention our other sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff who will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. Our wide range of services will ensure that you not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. You can call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. And if you mention that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, they will give you a free consultation, and they will get you 20% off your order. So check them out at Florida Alternative Medicine, and also be sure to go to our other sponsor's website, which is oldschoollabs.com. All right, that's it for opening. Here is our interview with Troy Zuccolato, 1989 MPC Nationals overall winner. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legend Show, and I have a very special guest with us this week. His name is Troy Zuccolato, and Troy was one of the best amateur bodybuilders in the 1980s, and he won the overall at the MPC Nationals in 1989, and then went on to have a pro career with both the WBF and also the IFBB. So, Troy, it's great to have you on the line. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate you having me.
All right. Well, let's start from the beginning, Troy, as we always do. What got you into bodybuilding when you were a youngster?
Well, I played football, and so I started lifting weights to try to gain size and strength, obviously, when I was younger. And then I guess, really, when I saw back in the day, you know, they used to, on Wide World of Sports, they used to show the Olympia.
Yeah.
Back then, and I remember seeing Arnold and Lou actually one of those years, and I was just really fascinated with bodybuilding. And so as I was lifting weights for football, I just started making gains really quick, but not so much in size for football, but quality gains for more like a bodybuilder's look. And so some guys at the gym, back then there was only the YMCA in my area to work out at. So some of the guys convinced me to compete in the show. So hell, I didn't even know what I was doing. So they said, let's try it. I think about 16 or 17 at the time. And I did, and I ended up getting second in the Orange County Classic.
Okay.
And that kind of just, you know, kind of made me forget about football and started concentrating on bodybuilding more. And then I just gradually started competing, ended up winning the LA, the Orange County, the California, and then so on and so on.
Yeah. What was your physique like, Troy, when you started? Because you said you were playing football. Were you a pretty husky kid naturally, or were you skinny?
I was naturally husky. And then I ended up getting mononucleosis, and I lost a bunch of weight.
Okay.
So I started basically lifting weights to get my strength back and my size back. The real reason I started lifting. So But I was fairly a bigger guy. You know, as I grew up, I was very big boned, that type of thing.
Yeah. What year were you born, Troy?
1962.
62, okay. So when you started training, when you started weight training, what kind of routine were you guys doing? Like, were you doing like a football routine? Were you just basically doing squats and deadlifts and just trying to increase your strength?
Squats and deadlifts like that in high school, yeah, because we had a high school gym. So back then, and then when I joined the YMCA, I started doing more isolated stuff because they had some more equipment there, and there was a couple of guys that were bodybuilders, and so I kind of watched them, how they trained, you know, doing more sets, doing giant sets, more isolated movements, and that's how I really learned from just watching other people in the gym.
Yeah, it's funny how you mentioned how you saw Arnold and Lou on Wide World of Sports, because I'm about your age. I was born in 63, so I'm a year younger than you. But I grew up during that era in the 80s, and it seemed like there were so many of us teenagers that were inspired by the bodybuilders of that day, you know, like those golden age bodybuilders like Arnold and Lou and Robbie and Zane and Mensur. It's just something about those physiques they had.
Serge Dubre. I mean, I look at Serge Dubre, and to me, he's one of the best physiques ever.
I know. Yeah.
You know, they talk about Arnold and everybody, but Serge was just, he was so complete, so aesthetic.
I know. Just looked like the perfect body just standing there.
Yeah, he really did. Yeah. And then he came actually in Orange County where I was after I had won the Teenage Mr. California. He actually happened to be there because he was friends with John Brown back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And, and he came in to work out at our gym. So I actually learned a lot from Serge Dubre as a young kid as far as training and diet, nutrition, and things like that. He was a super nice guy. He was very down-to-earth, very, very easygoing guy. But, yeah, I learned a lot from him.
What did you learn from him, Troy? Because I know he trained differently, right? He trained real light, a lot of sets. Even his diet was, like, super low carbs, right?
Are you still there?
Yeah.
I thought I lost you for a second. That's hard to give out cars. Yeah, you end up losing signals all the time.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Did you hear my question, Troy?
No, I'm sorry, I did.
Okay. I was saying, what did you learn from Serge? Because I know Serge Dubre trained really differently. He did a lot of sets, kind of lightweight, and then even his diet.
Yeah, he did Serge, you know, was interesting, and it's probably why he never really got injured. He never really trained that heavy. You know, back when I was a kid, everybody, you know, like Mensur, everybody trained heavy weights, and the guys in the gym were always using heavy, and so that's probably why my body's so beat up today, because I always thought you had to lift heavy all the time, heavy deadlifting, heavy squats. But it was interesting how Serge trained. You know, he rarely went heavy. He just really, everything was concentrated and focused on the muscle that he was doing. So actually later in my career, I started doing more of that because I was just getting injured all the time. My lower back, you know, just trying to go heavy all the time. And, but it was interesting how he just made his mind, you know, feel like the 30-pound dumbbell was 70 pounds just by the way he did the movement.
Right. Tell me about the first show you did, Troy, the first teenage show you did. What was that experience like?
It was interesting because, you know, I wasn't tan because they didn't have, you know, this is going back in, I believe, 1981 or 82, something like that. They had no pro tan or, you know, stuff they have today. I just went, you know, in my really thick posing trunks with tan lines on the legs.
Right.
And and I got second. So it just wasn't, you know, back then, even though it was the Orange County, there was in the teenage division, there wasn't really that many good teenagers like there obviously is today.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you get any feedback from any of the judges or anything?
Oh, everybody said, you know, because I didn't even diet. I mean, I had always ate good just because of the guys in the gym telling me how to eat protein drink, you know, protein drinks and do this and do that. So I really never had anybody teach me how to diet up to that point. So I was just working out, and I started getting, you know, leaner and harder, and the muscles started developing good. So that was the only reason I even decided to do a contest, because I was basically talked into it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So then you won this.
I did learn a lot
from the first show.
I learned there was obviously a lot more to it. I just, you know, somebody in the gym just taught me the basic, the mandatory posing, so I wouldn't look like a total idiot up there, you know, with how to do a side chest, a front lat spread, that kind of stuff. So I had no clue about doing that. So I just learned, like, in the last 4 weeks, how to do the mandatories and kind of put a routine together. And that's kind of, I kind of just winged it basically until as the next shows progressed, I did much better. You know, I learned a lot more as time went on.
How did you feel after that first show? Were you really hooked, or did you want to do another one?
Oh yeah. I thought, you know, there was like 45 teenagers and I ended up getting second. So I thought,
wow.
You know, damn. And then a lot of the actual promoter at that time was Mike Glass, who actually still promotes shows today.
Sure. Told me,
you know, you're going to have a big future in this if you keep it together and you just get in the right areas and the right people around you that'll teach you. So I just followed that. And, you know, I just kept progressing and progressing, learning how to train. And then I ended up going to Gold in Venice and ended up talking to Tom Platz back then.
No kidding.
He told me, you know, how I needed to do higher reps when you did legs because they're a larger muscle. So, you know, then I started doing, you know, instead of like 8 to 10 reps on squats, I started doing 20s and 25s. So my legs really started to develop and separate as the years went on.
Yeah. I'm looking at your contest history here. It says you took first place in the Mr. Physique USA and the teen division in 1980.
Yes,
Was that your first win? Yeah.
No, the orange, that was my first win, correct, yes.
Yeah.
And then I ended up winning the California, the Teenage California, a couple of years after that, a year after that, I think it was 81, I think I ended up winning that year. And then I went on to win the Mr. LA, and then I went into the open division, won the Junior Cal. And then I won the Cal in 86. And then I went on to the Nationals after that.
Okay. So who were you looking up to back then, Troy? Like, what bodybuilders were you aspiring to? Because you're probably, like, thinking you wanted to have a bodybuilding career at this point, right, when you're doing all those teenage shows?
Well, you know, I did want a bodybuilding career, but I wanted to really – my goal was never to win, like, the Olympia – and do it as a long-term career. My whole thing was I wanted to win the Nationals and turn pro and then use that to my advantage. Because, I mean, there's just not a – for what I wanted as far as myself, there just wasn't enough money in bodybuilding for me. It's a short career. There's one person that wins the show. It's like, I remember after I won the Nationals, Wayne D'Amelio came up to me and said, hey, what's your first pro show? You know, and generally after you win the Nationals, your first pro show is doing the Night of the Champions.
Right.
And he said, I'd like you to do the Night of Champions. And I said, Wayne, I said, the first place money is $10,000. I said, it's going to cost me 20 grand just to get ready for it. So as a business person, why would I spend 20 to make 10? I go, and that's only if I win. So it really made no sense to me to do it.
Yeah.
So, and even today I look at, you know, being the best in the world at what you do and you win 400 grand. I mean, that's a joke to me.
Yeah.
So it was just, you know, I'm not going to get out of bed if I can't make that in 2 months, you know, today. So right. It's just crazy. So for me, it was never my goal to be the top bodybuilder in the world. I wanted to use my titles to take advantage of it in the business world, basically.
So you had this attitude right from the beginning, right? Even when you were younger.
Right from the beginning. No, I wanted, I never, you know, of course, Mr. Olympia would have been a dream, but what it took to get there, whether I had the genetics to get there, probably not, because at that time Lee Haney was on top. And it just, for what it was going to cost me and the outcome that I would have got from it, it just wasn't enough for me. So I chose a different route, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it's interesting, Troy. I want to talk to you about your business in a little bit after we get done talking about your competitive career, because I think it's very interesting, because you're one of the few guys, one of the few bodybuilders, and it's interesting that you had that mindset even when you were younger. Because if you look at most bodybuilders, I think they do it for the passion, and they don't even care what they make. And like you said, you're going to spend so much money to get ready for these shows, and you're not going to make anything back. I mean, I remember right. One time I went to the Olympia one time with a friend of mine who was a real estate guy. And as we're sitting there and they're calling off like sixth place, fifth place, and they're saying, you know, this guy gets $5,000. And he goes, what? He goes, $5,000? That's all he's getting? You know, this guy's fifth place and the best in the world, or whatever it was, $10,000.
Yeah.
He couldn't believe that the money was so low, you know.
And it's sad, because there's really, and this is a knock against pro bodybuilders, but when I talk to a lot of them, they don't have anything. I mean, once they retire, they don't have much of anything anymore. And
right,
it's sad
right.
because here you're at the top of your, I mean, there's guys in the NFL that never get off the bench that make more than the best bodybuilder in the world.
Yeah, yeah. So why do you think you had that business type mindset at a young age? Were your parents financially successful, or was there somebody you knew that was doing well in business?
No, my parents were both school teachers, so I never came from money. My brother was very successful in business. He was a developer and he made a lot of money. So when I started making money through bodybuilding, he just said, "Hey, let me take that money and invest it for you, because we started, he owned car washes and mini store, just so I gave him money and just put him towards that. So I own several car washes now, mini storages, apartments. I own a medical company. I own a wine business. So it's, I just kept wanting to expand, because I knew, first of all, I didn't want to do all the things that was necessary to stay at top of your game. Far as health wise, I didn't want to risk, you know, any more than I've already have risked. And I just started getting injuries. You know, I was always tearing something, I knew that I couldn't sustain what I was doing for a long period of time. And, you know, I had two daughters, and I was like, you know, this is not going to cut it for me. I got to get into something else. And I had that vision, you know, even when I was in the teenage, that this wasn't going to be my ultimate goal, is to be the best bodybuilder in the world.
Yeah. But when you won the teenage, you must have thought, well, I've got the genetics. I could probably go, you know, to the top of the amateur division at least. And then were you thinking I could make some money off of that, like with guest posings and sponsorships and stuff?
Yeah. You know, I remember after I won the California, I got a contract with Weider. And back then, nobody got contracts. But Joe actually really liked my look. I was the blonde hair, blue eyed California guy.
Yeah. He looked like a California guy.
And that was his look. And so I ended up getting a contract with him. So I made some money there. And then I hustled. You know, I called every promoter about guest posing. I sent resumes out. And, you know, a lot of people, unfortunately, when you turn professional, they just think their phone's going to ring off the hook because everybody's going to want it. And it doesn't work that way. You know, you got to hustle to make money, especially in this sport, because they have too many people to choose from. And so I just made sure that my face was in front of their promoters when they were getting ready for a show. I was always sending them stuff saying I was available to guest post. And I always, and when I did, I always went to, you know, a lot of times I think bodybuilders get this ego, like they're better or they're great. And so they just do enough. They go on stage, they do their 2-minute posing routine, they get off, and then they go back to their hotel room. Well, you know, people like to interact with you, and the fans are what's paying your bills. So for me, I would do extra stuff. I would do TV shows or, you know, appearances for them, or I would go to the prejudging and I'd sit around and talk to people. I'd stay after the show because, you know, unfortunately, these bodybuilders get these big egos and, you know, that they're there for 2 minutes, they want their money and they get out.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, it sort of reminds me of when I talked to Sean Ray. He said the same thing when he won the Nationals in 87. He said right away he was sending out letters. I think he got a list of all the promoters or all the contests coming up in the next year in the MPC. And he sent every promoter a letter, and he really like tried to look at the business side of bodybuilding in order to make some money.
Exactly. You know, Sean and I grew up in the same areas, and we trained together for years. So, you know, when he turned pro, and then he was training with me when I turned pro, so we trained at the same gym. So, we kind of did a lot of things together. You know, Sean's a hustler as well. He's actually still kind of in the bodybuilding scene, which I'm not in there at all anymore. You know, I go to the Olympia every year just because it's in Vegas. And I got some gambling issues. So I love to gamble. So that makes it easy for me. Oh, let's go. Yeah, I'm definitely going to the Olympia. I don't even go to the show. I just go there.
Let me take you back to 86, Troy, when you won that California. Now, that was a big deal because the California was probably the most recognized state-level show in the country back then. That, you know, if you won the California, it was like everybody said, you're going to be a pro, you know. So that had to be a great high winning that 86 national – or not the Nationals, but the 86 California.
Right. It was. Yeah, usually the California champion is usually the heavy favorite for the Nationals. That winning the Cal opened a lot of doors for me. You know, like I said, it ended up get me a contract with Weider. I got some other contracts. I got one with Oakley sunglasses. I did stuff for Atomic Shoes. So yes, winning that did open me a lot of doors.
Now you went to the Nationals that year with that Stridham one in 86 and you got seventh. Were you disappointed that you only got seventh because you just won the California?
Yeah, but deservingly so. I just, you know, after that show, I was doing a lot of guest posing, and not to make an excuse, I just didn't have it mentally. You know, I missed a lot of gym time. My diet wasn't on and I was traveling, trying to make money. And so I just really, you know, deservingly so, I placed that in. I was way off for that show. And then I ended up going to the again next year, and I got third the year Phil Hill won. I ended up getting third that year, and then I took a year off and decided just to go to the USA, and that's the year Defendus won, and I got second.
Yeah, that was very close. That was very close between you guys.
Yeah, it was very close. You know, John kind of came out of, I don't know if retirement, but he hadn't competed in a while. He looked extremely good. It was very close between us two. And he ended up winning it, and I had no problem with that because I thought it was pretty close, and it could have gone either way, and so did he. Fortunately for him, it went that way. And so I just took the rest of the year off and concentrated and put all my efforts to do the Nationals in 89. And then I finally ended up winning it.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that USA, because I remember when that was on TV back then in the 80s, they had a lot of that stuff on ESPN. And, you know, you could see all those shows like the USA, the Nationals, the North America, they were all being covered. Right. So it was great. It was a great time for bodybuilding, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Today it's just, I don't know. It's a whole different look today than it was during my career, for sure.
Yeah. So tell me about 89, because that was the one finally you won after trying for the Nationals for, I think, 4 years in a row or 3 years in a row. You finally win the overall. So what was that like? That was a tough show, too. You beat out Aaron Baker and a lot of great
Aaron
guys.
Baker, Jim Quinn. You know, guys that I was doing show after show, Johnny Morant. You know, it seemed like we were all always in the shows, and it was, you know, going back and forth. And I just knew that year that I wasn't going to get beat. I had just dialed my body in perfectly for that show. And I knew, you know, if I didn't win this year, I was done, because I knew I couldn't get any better as far as condition and everything else. And if it wasn't going to work, then it was time for me to move on. I wasn't going to keep going back year after year. I had other things that I wanted to do in my life, and I was hoping to win it so I can, you know, obviously use this to further my career. But I did. I dialed in perfectly, and fortunately, I ended up winning that and then beating Franco and for the overall, because Franco was in great condition as well.
Yeah, he was a great bodybuilder.
Yeah, he was. Really good.
What did you weigh for that, Troy? Do you remember what your weight was?
I weighed 234 for that show.
234. Okay. Big guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember all those shows you did, because I'd follow the contest pretty close back then, and you were in great shape for every show. I mean, you had to really learn more and more each year about peaking, right?
Yeah, you do. I always came in good condition, you know. Sometimes it just wasn't enough, but I, you know, even as the shows progress, you always learn something different about your body. No matter how much you think you know your body or how dialed you in, you learn from every show. You learn a different experience of what you could have did better, what you should have not have done, what you should have done, and it's a learning curve. And I think you could almost ask any bodybuilder, they learn, you know, you could do 15, 20 shows and you're learning something different each show.
Yeah. 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 Like I said, I remember every show you were dialed in, but you just kept getting better each year. So you were learning, like you said, you were learning from each show, and and then shows were very tough back then. There was only, five pro cards a year, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Now you can win Mr. Neighborhood and they give you a pro card.
Right. It is.
So, yeah. But, yeah, it's just the bodybuilding today is just so – I'm glad I'm not a part of it today. It's just so diluted. I mean, half these people I see walking around that says IFBB Pro, and I'm like, who? I never even heard of you, and they're IFBB Pro. So, right. You know, back in our day, I knew everybody. The top five, they were in all the magazines.
Oh, you know?
Were talked about all year long. And so when Jim Quintero or Aaron Baker or David Durth or, you know, Franco, I knew all these guys prior to this because we were all getting magazine coverage. So,
yeah.
You know, we were all, you know, right there ready to turn pro. And then I look at, you know, now I see these guys that I've never even heard of. 90% of these guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go ahead.
Do you think the difference is because the magazines went away because of social media, you know, because the internet now is here and all the magazines
faded? I think that's a lot of it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a business. You know, bodybuilding's a business. The more pros you got, the more money you make.
Right. You know, what do you think about all these divisions, you know, men's physique, classic physique?
I think it's ridiculous. I really do.
I think,
you know, there's just, you know, when you're a pro bodybuilder, it's like, you know, when I won the nationals, you had to win the nationals, your class, or the overall at the USA and the North American. That's the only way you could turn pro. Now you can win this guy over 40 that comes back from Pittsburgh and he wins it, and now he's a pro. I'm like, you have to, it's a joke to me. It really is. It's anybody can turn pro these days.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take much. And then they're taking the top two or whatever anymore. It's just crazy.
Yeah.
There's no quality to me. And I think that's why you see such less quality of bodybuilders, pro bodybuilders, because there's so many of them now.
Right. Yeah, I mean, look at what you had to go through.
You had to earn it. I mean, I had to win my class, and that against those guys, that was hard every single year to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Every year somebody was going, you know, and you had to win. That's the only way you got to turn pro.
I know. Yeah, you had to come back year after year after year in order to finally beat these guys.
Exactly. It was crazy.
And like you said, that's exactly what you said. When the contest was coming up, you knew who the top five were going to be. You knew who the favorites were going
in. Right away. I knew. I remember Matt Mendenhall, who I thought he had a wonderful physique. Matt just never seemed to dial it in perfectly as far as condition, but as far as structure. And I remember the year I won the Nationals, and I look and there's Matt Mendenhall sitting in his sweats, and I go, fuck me. I'm going to fucking lose again. Because I knew if he was on, I can't beat him. He was structurally better than me.
Right.
And I remember seeing him take his sweats off, and I seen he was over, and I was like, yes, he's not in shape. So right. I took a big sigh of relief away from me, because I always thought Matt was incredible. And just, you know, him and Rory Liedemeyer back in the days, those were the guys that structurally were so good, but they just never got it together on the day of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a shame, too. Because
always
they
a little bit of off. You always just slightly off. Because they were both so good.
I look at old pictures of those guys, and I'm like, man, how did they not turn pro? Those guys should have been in the Olympia up against Haney, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They were both just genetically, structurally gifted, for sure.
Right. What do you think of the physiques today, Troy, compared to like how the physiques were in the 80s?
The pros, I think, I would, if somebody came up to me right now and said, Troy, I can just make you look like the current Mr. Olympia and you're going to win today, I would say, I don't even want it, and I don't want to look like that. It just, to me, it just isn't a look that I think looks good. It's like a bloated cartoon character. That's what I look at it. There's no quality. There's no separation. I mean, you look at the guys from the 80s, the Sean Rays, the Flex Wheelers, you know, guys like us back in the, you know, the mid 80s, early 90s, the Kevin Lebronis, the Rich Gasparis. That's condition. That's bodybuilding to me. That's separation. You're not freaky huge like these guys today with your stomach extended way beyond. I mean, these guys, they do the synthol, they inject all this shit into their bodies. It's just, there's nothing quality or pleasing about it to me whatsoever.
Right. Yeah, I feel the same way. I mean, I kind of grew up in the 80s, so that's a sentimental thing for me, you know, because that's the era I grew up in, and they say that the era that you competed in, that's always the era you think is the best. But what I liked about the guys from the 80s was the physique still looked attainable. You know, I mean, everybody was using drugs, of course, but the bodies looked like human bodies. It looked like something you could attain if you trained hard enough. Now it seems like they're so freaking big. It's like they're, like you said, they're like cartoon characters. They're just overblown. And I don't think anybody can really relate to it. Like, I don't think the average person who's into bodybuilding would look at that and say, I can look like that. You know, I think everybody knows what it takes to really achieve that kind of physique that the guys have today.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
So after you win that Nationals, what was the outcome of that? Like, you know, were you getting more sponsorships? Were you getting offers?
Yeah, I started doing a lot of traveling. Like, I'd go over to SIBO every year. And then, unfortunately, you know, that's when Vince McMahon started the WBF. So he started, you know, when I was one of the athletes. You know, for me, it couldn't have been more timing perfect for me, because I had just turned pro and Vince wanted all the top pros. And at that time, I was on every magazine cover. I was probably the most publicized bodybuilder at that time, just because I had just won the Nationals. And, you know, obviously Weider loved my look. So Vince was one of I was one of the guys Vince really wanted to come over. So for me, I ended up getting one of the larger contracts.
Really?
And so I did real well financially. And for me, it was the best move I ever made.
Yeah.
Because I would have never made that money, even if I had won the Olympia, the amount of money I made in the WBF. And I ended up getting a 3-year deal from them. So I actually got paid for 3 years. So it was worth every bit of me going over there.
Yeah, even though the organization only lasted like 2 years, you got paid for three?
I got paid for three, yes, because I negotiated, being a businessman, I negotiated a 3-year deal. So it was all under the WWF, so they legally had to pay me even after the organization folded. So I had a year left where I got paid and didn't have to do anything.
Yeah, when I talked to Sean, I think he mentioned your name. I think he said you were getting more money than he was. And he's like, man, I won the Nationals before him, and I've done pro shows, and And they were giving you more money because they just literally liked your look, right? The blonde hair and the California look.
You know, and again, we all know that that was going to be kind of like the wrestling deal. There was going to be, you know, we were all going to have characters and there was a certain person going to win each year, just kind of like wrestling. And I was fine with that. You know, place me last. I don't care. I'm making the money. I don't care. Right. This is business for me. You know, right. So I didn't care about winning any of those shows. I was worried about is how much I was making. That's the bottom line for me. It was all about the money at that point.
Yeah. So you never said, no, I don't want to do this new organization. I want to do the Olympia. I want to, you know, go the IFBB route. Never. Like a lot of other guys said. Never. No.
Never. Never. Because I knew in my mind that if this ever failed, Weider would take me back, regardless if they said we were suspended for life. I remember right after the IFBB or the WBF folded, within a month, Weider was already calling me, asking me to come back over and signing, and I ended up signing a contract. And I remember being at a Weider meeting. The athletes were pissed off because they had allowed like me and Eddie Robinson and Gary Stridham to come back over, and they were kind of upset, the IFBB people, because we were considered supposedly banned for life. That they weren't ever going to take us back, but it's business, you know. It's business for Joe. Joe's a businessman, and a certain look sells his magazines, and he wanted them back over.
Right, right. What did you think about the WBF? The way it was run, like the way the contests were run and stuff. They tried something different. They tried to make it more like a kind of like a wrestling
show,
right?
Make it more, and I thought, you know, if the issue with Hulk Hogan having those issues, you know, getting caught with steroids or whatever the reason was, if none of that happened, I really think it could have been successful because Vince had the money to do it. I think he could have created it kind of like the wrestling was, but just in bodybuilding. I really think that there wasn't so much pressure on Vince to start drug testing us, which he had to start doing to keep his, you know, obviously his wrestling organization afloat. You know, that just killed the sport, killed it basically for us.
Yeah. What kind did they actually do the drug testing? Was it real legit?
Oh yeah. No, I was drug tested every single week.
Wow. Really? No kidding.
Every week. And it was random. They said, you got 24 hours to be here. Yeah. That wasn't a joke. We were tested. I mean, now I don't know if everybody was tested, but I know I was. I was tested every single week, and I could see it in my physique. I just didn't look like I normally looked. And you know, I remember the second WBF show. I dieted harder and trained harder than I ever did in my life, and I still looked about an eighth of what I did.
Wow! Really?
So,
wow!
So you just can't. It's just. You know, unfortunately, it just wasn't working because, you know, you can go to a gym and see bigger freaks in the gym than you could on as a pro bodybuilder. You know, and it just people didn't want to see that. But, you know, people pay to see the freaky guys up on stage.
Yeah, yeah. And you got off everything, right, Troy? I mean, you didn't try to beat the test.
Everything. Not one thing. Yeah. Because if I had tested positive, then I was going to lose my contract. And I was forget that. I don't care if I get down to 140 pounds. I want that money.
right. Yeah, because I look at like how Stridham looked in that second WBF show, and he didn't look like he was off anything, you know. So, they were testing you, but they might not have been testing everybody.
And I don't know that Gary looked incredible, and Gary's a good friend of mine, and I have a lot of respect for him. I think he's an incredible bodybuilder, but I don't know. You know what they did to Gary, or what they didn't do to Gary. I just know he looked phenomenal, and I think he's a fantastic bodybuilder.
Yeah. So then, when that ended, you said you were going to go back to the IFBB, and then Weider took you back. And then, what other shows did you do then after you got back?
I came back when I was under contract, and I, you know, now you got to remember, I hadn't taken anything for over 2 years, so. I had to compete in less than three months. He wanted me to do a show right away. I was like, Joe, I haven't even done anything, you know? So I did the best I could, and I did the Chicago Pro Show, and I didn't even make the top 15. So, and rightfully so. I looked horrible, but I did the best I could. And then after that, I was pretty much done. I had a lot of other things that were in my business that I wanted to do. I was doing super well in my other businesses, and I was like, I'm done with bodybuilding. I'm going to put my efforts into this because I can make a lot more money. And so that's kind of what I did. I think my last show was in 95. I think it was 95 was the last show I did.
Okay. Yeah, let me ask you about your business, Troy, if you don't mind talking about that. Because I think, like I said, I think you're one of the most financially successful bodybuilders. I talked to a lot of bodybuilders on the show, and I talked to guys that were champions, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s. And like you said, a lot of them are struggling now. They don't have any money.
Yeah.
So what did you do, you know, to set up your financial career for yourself? Like, sort of take me along the steps of how you were so successful.
Well, you know, the first thing you have to be is relentless, and I'm just relentless at everything I do. I never tell me somebody that it can't be done, Troy. You can't do this, or it's going to be too hard. That just creates a challenge for me. So, I never understood that, because bodybuilding is so disciplined and it takes so much energy and discipline and mindset, that if you're able to do that, why can't you just take that into the business area too? To me, a bodybuilder that is disciplined that should be successful at anything he does if he's that disciplined. But it's so unfortunate, because I'm telling you, 95% of the people I know don't have anything. They live in apartments. They just train people here and there, trying to get by. They just, no future, no retirement, no nothing for, you know, what's going to happen when they can't train people? If they physically can't going to do it, they're going to be homeless.
Yeah.
And nobody sets them up. They live in this moment of, you know, yes, I'm in the Olympia. I'm winning here. I'm the gray. I'm selling my magazines. I'm doing blah, blah, blah. But that is so short-lived. It's going to be gone, and then you're going to have nothing, and that's unfortunate. So for me, I knew that I had to take this elsewhere and make money. So when I started doing the car washes, we ended up doing two, then I ended up doing four, then I ended up getting six, and then I started buying mini storages, building those, creating those, and expanding those. And then I started my longevity centers, which I've had now for 25 years. That's my main business. I do all the hormone therapy, the stem cell, Botox, fillers, lasers. I do, you know, I have locations. So I just have my hands in everything. And for me, it's just, I'm never content. I always want more. And now I own a wine company, along with my daughter, that's doing extremely well. And so I'm up at 4 o'clock every morning, and I don't go to bed till 11 o'clock. So I love the results, and, you know, I made more money than I ever thought I would in my entire life. I could retire right now and live comfortably the rest of my life and not have to do anything. But, you know, the competitiveness in me just wants more, basically.
Yeah. So you said really that the key is, if these bodybuilders took the same passion and desire and dedication and discipline that they put into bodybuilding, which is a lot. We know that it takes an incredible amount of hard work and discipline to be a bodybuilder, even to be a state level bodybuilder. It just takes unbelievable discipline. If they applied those same principles to making money, they would be successful.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's the unfortunate thing, because nobody does.
Right, right. Yeah, I see that all the time, too. I see so many bodybuilders who, you know, like you said, they put everything into the bodybuilding, but when it comes to the rest of their life, they just kind of lay back, and it's not the same.
Exactly.
Maybe they just don't have the passion for making money that they did for bodybuilding.
You know, that's the thing. It's like it's just hard for me to fathom that you can't do more with your life when you've been so successful. I mean, to get to the pro, you have to be determined, and you give up a lot, you risk a lot. And I just don't understand why they don't take that into the business world. But so many of them just cannot take that know, when I retired officially, when I retired officially, I didn't care. My ego wasn't big enough where, I'm not in the magazines anymore. No one's asking for my photos, for my picture. I could give a rat's ass. Mm-hmm. You know, I care about what my bank account looks like. That's what I care about.
Yeah. Tell me about that longevity center, because I think you were probably one of the first ones to do that, right? I mean, you said you've been doing it for 25 years.
I've had
years.
It now 26 years now in March, in April. I've had it 26. Yeah, I was the first one in my area. I remember when HGH got approved for anti-aging purposes. Mm-hmm. I knew that this, you know, I live in Newport Beach. There's a lot of money. People out here love, you know, they spend the money to look better, feel better. And I knew that being in Newport, that this was going to be big. So I ended up going to the American Academy of Anti-Aging. I got certified to open a clinic, and then I hired a physician as my medical director. And so I just started promoting it. I actually had a couple of ads in Muscle and Fitness because I was still on contract with Weider at the time. So he gave me some free ad space. So I did some advertising in Muscle and Fitness with it. And then I just started getting clients, and it just kept growing and growing. Then I put another one in La Jolla. I'm in Dallas. So I started expanding those, and it's been a super successful business and something that I really enjoy because I'm into, you know, skincare, how you look, how you feel, replacing hormones for just, you know, optimal for health purposes more than anything. So it's been a great journey for me for sure.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about your wine business, Troy, because when I was in Vegas.
So I started, my daughter had always wanted to do something with me in business, and she came up with this thing called Shardy Party because, you know, she would get together with her friends all the time and say, oh, we're having a Shardy Party, or, you know, their bachelorette parties or just get-togethers. And so I said, I like that name. I said, we should patent that and do something with it. So I ended up patenting it, and then decided to, you know, try to sell this, make this a wine business. So I went and got with a business, my business attorney, told him what I was looking to do, got with a winery that could actually make it, hired some of these sommeliers, or whatever you call those guys, the guys that do the wine, because I don't drink. I never drink. So I would know if drinking a Boone's Farm or this, what's the difference? So for me, I hired somebody to really get the taste down for me. So we started just doing a Chardonnay. We launched in February, and we're in like 18 restaurants, in all kinds of liquor stores around here. And now I'm expanding. I'm going to be in all the clubs in Vegas. I just signed a deal with Kroger Foods to be in all Kroger, Ralph's, and Food for Less. So it's going to be huge. This thing is going to be probably my biggest deal I've ever done eventually. Wow. So it's been going really well.
Oh,
and again, you know, for me, I know nothing about the wine business, but I know enough of work ethic to make it happen. And if I don't know how to do it, I'll find somebody that will, and I'll figure it out.
Right.
And I think that's the whole key is figuring it out, because no, I'm not a wine expert. And people go, well, you know nothing about wine. I don't care if I know about wine. I know about business, and I'll find somebody that knows about wine that'll take me there, and I'll pay him to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
So that's kind of how the wine business started, and it's been doing extremely well.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. Well, congratulations on that latest venture, Troy.
I appreciate that.
All right, Troy. Well, listen, I've taken up enough of your time. I'm sure you're busy, so I just want to thank you for joining us on the show. It was a very enlightening interview. I really wanted to ask you about your career, and I also wanted to ask you about your, you know, your business projects, because, like I said, I think that really separates you from most other bodybuilders out there. So that was some great information you gave us.
I appreciate it. It was a pleasure talking to you guys as well.
All right, Troy. Well, thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll talk again soon, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right, Troy. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank Troy Zuccolato for taking time out of his busy schedule so he could join us on the show and do that interview. I really appreciate that, Troy. I also want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs, and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode. All right, now, without further ado, I'm going to read this article, which was in the March 1985 issue of Muscle Mag International. It is written by Greg Zulak, and of course, it is of the Mr. Olympia report, which took place in November at the Felt Forum in Madison Square Garden in New York. So here we go. The 1984 Mr. Olympia contest returned to New York, its origin and birthplace, after an absence of 10 years and before an enthusiastic capacity crowd at Madison Square Garden's Felt Forum. A tremendously improved Lee Haney, looking totally awesome, was crowned the new Mr. Olympia. Mohamed Mekawe, the magic Egyptian, once again for the second year in a row, had to be satisfied with second place. Mekawe was as near perfect as a bodybuilder can be, but it was simply a case of a good big man beating a good little man. In strong third place was the mighty German Josip Wilkosch in his all-time best shape. And if Haney hadn't shown up in such incredible shape, many felt Josip could have been judged as the Mr. Olympia trophy back in 1980 right now. The show had about everything you'd expect of a Mr. Olympia contest, which ran the whole gamut of human emotion. Tremendous excitement, eager anticipation, comedy, and even a little pathos. Sadness, and disappointment too. And of course, enough huge, thick, defined muscle to satisfy any hardcore muscle aficionado. Before the contest, the rumors were flying thick and fast. Boyer Coe, Roy Callender, Chris Dickerson, Robbie Robinson, and Bill Grant were all reportedly entering the Olympia once more. Tony Pearson was also supposed to have been given special permission to compete. The thought of all these great former champs returning to compete was thrilling. New York's Olympia was setting up to be the best ever. There was great excitement over the fact that the Golden Eagle, Mr. Legs himself, Tom Platz, was returning to compete too, and I had it on good authority that Tom was looking absolutely awesome. I heard too from writer Bob Gallup, who had been up to California the week before, and said Samir Banute was in tremendous shape and ready to defend his title. I had myself seen Mohamed Mekawe guest pose only 7 days before the Olympia, and I knew he was ripped and ready. And everyone wanted to know if Mike Christian, the recent American and world amateur heavyweight champion, would compete. But the biggest excitement was caused by the rumored return of the one and only myth, Sergio Oliva, after a 12-year absence from Olympia competition. From speaking with Sergio a few times over the course of the year, I knew that it was no rumor. The question was, could Sergio get into top shape again and compete against the likes of Banute, Mekawe, Beckles, and Haney in New York, where mass and size are king? Many were beside themselves to find out. I know I could hardly wait to see the big man on stage. Everyone I spoke with agreed. If Sergio showed up like he did in Essen, Germany in 1972, where he scared the bejesus out of a young Arnold Schwarzenegger, everyone may as well compete for second place, for there would be no doubt who the winner would be. There were some disappointments before the show, too. Frank Zane, Casey Viator, Greg DeFerro, and Bertel Fox were all forced to cancel out. I heard that DeFerro had come down with an unfortunate illness, and Fox had a back injury. Frank Zane's injured shoulder prevented him from training as he wanted to act as a commentator for NBC. Frank Zane's injured shoulder prevented him from training as he wanted, so he acted as a commentator for NBC TV instead. Frank came on stage and said not to count him out yet, and that he may return to competition in Belgium the next year. I did not find out why Viator didn't show up. It's too bad because I heard he'd been training very hard in Tucson, and he would have made a great addition to the show. For some reason, Danny Padilla was a no-show. Even with Zane, Viator, Padilla, Fox, and DeFerro out, there were still 20 top competitors in the show, the largest Mr. Olympia ever. There was actually some talk about eliminating the 5 lowest placing competitors after the prejudging for posing at the evening show, but this idea was dropped, much to the relief of many of the competitors. The evening before the competition, the judges meeting was held to give the competitors a chance to voice any complaints or grievances beforehand. As I entered the room, it was like I had gone to muscle heaven. I was transformed by more muscle than most people get to see in a lifetime. Banute, Wilkosch, Dickerson, Platz, Grant, Pearson, Robbie, Chuck Williams, Charles Glass, and much more. Wilkosch, Dickerson, Platz, Grant, Pearson, Robbie, Chuck Williams, Charles Glass, Bob Birdsong, and the others all sat near the front. In the very last row sat Boyer Coe, and besides him, the myth, looking as he told me he would in the phone a few weeks earlier, big, black, and ripped. I made my way to the back and shook Sergio's hand, seeing if he'd remember me from my short stay in Chicago when I had done some articles on him. "Hey, how's it going, my man?" I said as I vigorously shook my hand. And then, as if he'd ready to read my mind, he said, "Oh yeah, I'm ready." Boyer Cope, upon hearing this, grimaced and a worried look crossed his face. We spoke a bit more, and then IFBB President Ben Weider called for a meeting to start. Ben gave a speech in which he emphasized to all the competitors that the IFBB has done everything possible to ensure a fair decision tomorrow and at a great expense. The various best judges have been brought in to judge. And since there's only one judge from each of seven different countries, it's impossible to fix the contest. Also, there was to be two alternative judges and a scrutineer. If any judge or judges showed obvious bias and or incompetence after the first round of the prejudging, they would be replaced by one of the alternate judges. Although the speech was for all the bodybuilders in general, I think it was aimed specifically at Sergio. Everyone knew of Sergio's past problems with the Weiders, and Ben wanted to make it clear before the contest. When Ben asked if the competitors were satisfied with the judges or were there any complaints, of course, no one spoke up. To complain would single out a competitor for possible retribution from the judge accused of being biased or incompetent, and no one wanted to risk that. Ben Weider also announced that each competitor from first to last would receive a small medallion, and for the first time, the first three would receive large, and I mean large, additional medallions, as in the Olympic tradition, gold for first, silver for second, and bronze for third. All during the meeting, the Weider photographers, Mike Nevue and Bill Dobbins, were shooting photos of the various bodybuilders, as was Gary Bartlett, who at this contest was doing photos not only for Muscle Mag, but for Ironman, Muscle Training Illustrated, and several other magazines. When Joe Weider went over to speak to Sergio, the cameras really started clicking, especially when Sergio and Joe stood up and shook hands. It seemed everyone wanted words with the myth, but because of the two-part article run by Muscle Mag International, he spent most of his time talking to Bob Kennedy and myself. "I say this about Sergio, if you're good to him, he's good to you." At one point, Rick Wayne came out and Sergio said to Ricky, pointing at me, "He did some good articles on me, and he's really helped me a lot." At which point, Ricky looked at me and asked coolly, "Who are you?" I replied, "Zulek." And Ricky said, "Oh, arrogance personified," and walked away. Finally, my curiosity got the better of me, and I had to ask Sergio to show me his chest. Lowering his sweat top to expose his massive chest, he flexed his right pec. As he bunched it up, I could see all the striations and muscle fibers. Then without asking, he raised his sweat top up and he let me feel his abs. My fingers went in up to my knuckle and was hard as a rock. He seemed ready to me, and I was especially pleased that he had tanned and he was a nice dark brown rather than his usual sallow yellow tone. He told me that he weighed 240 pounds. Personally, I'd have liked to have seen him at 230 pounds or even 225 pounds, but who am I to tell Sergio Oliva what weight to compete at? The next morning, I was to spend half an hour in Sergio's suite with his wife, Arlene, and their new two-week-old baby, Sergio Jr. Up at 5:30 to carb up with some pancakes and syrup, Sergio was now restless for the prejudging to start. It was still 3 hours away. I briefly went over with him what to expect at the prejudging, and he assured me he had his posing down and he was ready. There was little more for me to do but wish him luck and then leave him to prepare himself for battle. As the felt forum filled with fans, the excitement in the air was so thick you could slice it with a knife. When Wayne D'Amelio asked everyone to be seated because the contest was about to start, a tremendous roar of approval went up, and the roar only got louder when the Olympia contestants finally filed on stage, with Sergio Oliva leading the way. Cries of "Sergio, Sergio" echoed throughout the room, followed by screams of the name of the other bodybuilders by the fans of their favorite bodybuilder. Three women directly behind me all screamed in unison, "Samir," at which a big grin broke out on Samir's face. My eyes quickly scanned up and down the lineup trying to pick out those bodybuilders in shape and those not. All the while, the combined throes of the crowd threatened to lift the roof off the building. Looking up and down the lineup, I noticed McAway ripped and supremely confident, a big smile on his face. McAway and Wilkosh were huge and cut. Beckles, Paris, and Birdsong, all in top shape. And at the end of the stage, Samir smiling confidently, and Sergio looking a bit confused and overwhelmed. Haney and Wilkosh huge and cut, Beckles, Paris, and Birdsong all in top shape, and at the end of the stage, Samir smiling confidently, and Sergio looking a bit confused and overwhelmed. There were so many competitors that Sergio was forced to stand away off in the darkened corner of the stage. Looking angry and frustrated, I'm sure that at that point he felt it was some kind of plot to keep him out of the judges' eyes. When the competitors came on stage, the fans rushed to the stage like groupies at a rock concert, and as I left my seat, I had to fight my way through a horde of fans to get to the stage. Seeking to placate Sergio, I screamed so I could be heard above the crowd. "Don't worry, Sergio. They'll move you in a minute. Don't worry." Fortunately, just then, Big Julie Levine came on stage and informed Sergio and Samir that in another minute or two, all competitors would be shifted around so that those on the corners would be moved into the center stage and vice versa. It seemed to calm Sergio, and I returned to my seat. It was quite a sight to see all those top bodybuilders, all in good shape and a few in super shape, on stage at once. One thing for sure, it would be a tough contest to judge, and I don't envy the judges' spot. After round one of the prejudging, I was better able to sort out my mind who was in the fight for the top spots. I did it the way the IPB rulebook suggests, sorting into three groups. The first group of bodybuilders would be in the top spots. The second group was those for the middle of the pack, and a third group for those coming in the last places. My group, one, consisted of the following: Lee Haney, Muhammad Makawe, Samir Banut, Bob Birdsong, Al Beckles, Joseph Wilkosh, and Sergio Oliva and Bob Paris. My second group consisted of Tom Platz, Roy Callender, Chris Dickerson, Tony Pearson, and Boyer Coe. My third group had Chuck Williams, Bill Grant, Charles Glass, Robbie Robinson, Hubert Metz, James Gobert, and Appy Steinbeck. After round one, I had it Haney, Wilkosh, Makawe, Banut, Oliva, and Beckles, but I felt that Bob Birdsong could possibly crack the top six. When the judges began calling for comparisons, the only real surprise to me was the number of times that Roy Callender was called out for comparisons. To me, Roy had come in a little heavy and smooth. I didn't even have him in the top 10. I kept wondering what the judges saw that I didn't. Except for Big Roy, it was apparent that the judges were pretty unified as who the top six or seven physiques were. Lee Haney, Joseph Wilkosh, Muhammad Makawe, Al Beckles, Samir Banut, Bob Paris, and Sergio Oliva were all called out for the most comparisons, and Haney, Makawe, Wilkosh, and Beckles were all compared against one another more than the others. It seems that at least after round one, these were the top men according to the judges. I might add that during round one, only Sergio Oliva and Tom Platz showed any fighting spirit, and they were the only ones who did extra poses. Once, after having been called up to be compared with Chris Dickerson and Tom Platz for a few compulsory poses, Sergio hit a few most muscular shots, classic arms and overhead poses, which created tremendous excitement and brought a huge roar of approval. It was like a flashback to the 1969 Mr. Olympia. This started a chain reaction, and soon everybody on stage was hitting their best shots. It took several exciting minutes for order to be restored. I think the bodybuilders enjoyed it as much as the fans. Robbie and Platz in particular seemed to get a big kick out of this spontaneous onslaught of muscular display. During round two, I saw nothing which changed my mind or the judges' collective minds either as to who the top men were. Lee Haney, Makawe, and Wilkosh, besides being three of the most cut and muscular physiques in the show, were also three of the most symmetrical and proportional, which round one judges. So there'd be no change in places here. I expected Dickerson, Banut, and Birdsong, and Paris and Oliva all to improve their places in the round, while Beckles, Callender, and Platz had dropped a little bit. Round two produced some comic relief for the judges, fans, and bodybuilders alike. Tom Platz kept posing during the relaxed round and was admonished by the head judge for doing so. Each time, Tom, an angelic look on his face, "Who, me?" would point to his ear as if to say, "Sorry, I couldn't hear the pose called for because of the noise." This happened several times. Finally, Samir Banut leaned over and whispered in Tom's ear as if to tell him what pose to do, while Platz theatrically thanked him. Then a few minutes later, Samir did extra poses, and when the judge admonished him, Samir too appeared to have developed a hearing problem, and he pointed at his own ear. The crowd roared with laughter. That ended the prejudging, and everyone quickly left to return to their hotels to eat and rest and get ready for the big evening show. In the interest of space, I'll give a short description of the 20 men from last to first as they were placed by the judges. 20th place went to Appie Steenbeck from Holland. Coming in last in a contest could usually be deemed a disgrace, but this was an extremely tough contest. Don't forget, every contestant was either a former Mr. Universe, Mr. World, Mr. Olympia, or both. When you get 20 Mr. Universes together, someone's got to finish last, and today it was Appie. This was his first pro contest and first Olympia, so no matter where he placed, I'm sure it was a big thrill for him just to be on stage with men like Haney, McAway, Oliva, and Benute. Although Appie had good color and was very hard-looking and obviously in good shape, he was lacking in calves, thighs, arms, and overall size. His posing failed to generate any excitement. What had been good enough to win the lightweight Mr. Universe title against other men of his size was clearly not enough when standing next to monsters like Oliva, Haney, and Wilkosch. Appie was the smallest man in the entire contest, and one can't help but wonder what possesses a person like that to train so hard to compete in the world's biggest contest when he realistically has no chance of doing well. I don't mean to criticize. I couldn't carry Appie's gym bag, but I think many men have delusions of grandeur and are not in touch with reality. In 19th, James Gobert from the USA. I found it difficult to criticize James Gobert, except to again question his judgment of his training and dieting so hard and going at all the expense of preparing for the Olympia when genetically you just are not as gifted as the other men and realistically cannot expect to do well. James acted like a real pro on stage and during the prejudging and evening show, even though it was only his second pro contest and second Olympia. The former Mr. Universe had excellent color and he was very hard looking and cut. It was evident that he had prepared himself well and he had done much with his body as his genetics and humanity allowed, but he lacks the size and shape to be competitive for the top spots. And he fails to create an impact with his posing. It wasn't a matter of Gobert being so bad or out of shape. It was just a matter of all the other guys being so much better. Personally, I think he's one of the most underrated physiques around. 18th, Hubert Metz from Germany. The problem with Metz, like Gobert, was not his condition, but a problem with genetics. He just doesn't have what it takes to win or even finish in the top 10. You have to admire and respect Hubert for all the hard work put in building his physique, and he is a former Mr. Universe, but he's at the outer limits of his genetic capability. He's gone as far as he can go. Today he was cutting hard, he had good color, and he posed adequately, but he failed to make an impression. He had poor abs for a big man and several other good body parts, but as a total package, he presents an odd and ungainly put together physique. 17th, Robbie Robinson from the USA. The Black Prince of bodybuilding, sporting a Grace Jones haircut, showed up in probably his worst shape ever for an Olympia. It wasn't that he was fat or anything like that, but compared to the Robbie of 6 or 7 years ago when Robbie was the head honcho and the man to beat, the Robbie I saw today was but a shadow of his former self. He was smooth, especially when relaxed, and definitely lacked holding water. Also, during the prejudging, he kept doing compulsory poses wrong, and he had to be corrected several times as to the proper way of doing the compulsory poses. As far as feet and hand position, one wonders how an old seasoned pro like Robbie would forget how to do the compulsory poses. His free posing routine was dull and lifeless. It's sad because here is a man with the genetic potential to do well. 16th, Charles Glass from the USA. Charles Glass was another disappointment to me. His rock-hard muscularity, which he showed at last year's Mr. Universe, was not in evidence today. Perhaps he felt wrongly that he had to have more size in order to be competitive in the Olympia, and the additional size smoothed him out a bit. Under the harsh lights, he seemed washed out, and even his color seemed pale. While tensing, he looked cut and hard, but when he was relaxed, he was just too smooth. His posing was short, but created some excitement because it contained two backflips and a planche move. 15th, Bill Grant from the USA. There was a lot of disappointed fans at the contest on Saturday, November 3rd, but few more disappointed than Bill Grant. His girlfriend told me Bill did not expect to crack the top six, but he did expect to make the top 10 and be in the money. 10th would have earned Bill $1,000. When Wayne D'Amelio announced the top 10 finalists, Bill's name was called out, and then a few minutes later, a correction was made, and Bill was off the list. Talk about being built up only to come crashing down. Before the contest, Bill told me that he was 10 pounds heavier than he was at the World Championships in Toronto. in February, where he placed third. And he, too, was obviously felt that he had to pack on some extra size, which may have smoothed him out. The hardness of muscle, especially when relaxed, just was not there. And Bill's skin appeared too light on stage. Apparently, he had trouble tanning while living and training in Sweden. 14th, Chuck Williams from the USA. After winning his class at the Mr. Universe last year, defeating the likes of Tim Belknap, great things were expected of Chuck at the Olympia. But like Glass, Grant, and so many others, he showed up in less than top form. He was cut and hard, but not ripped. It was unfortunate because he had great arms, good legs, chest, abs, and back, and overall muscularity and good balance, all the ingredients to do well. But as I said so many times in this article, being cut isn't good enough anymore. You got to be ripped to the bone with chisel-in separation, dazzling definition, and rock-hard muscularity. And that's not even good enough to guarantee a top six finish anymore. And Williams wasn't. At a lesser contest, his form would have put him in one of the top spots, but here he was 14th. That shows how tough the Olympia is. Chuck, too, probably tried to gain a little too much size, and he ended up sacrificing cuts and vascularity. 13th, Boyer Coe. This was Boyer's first Olympia in 2 years, and it was nice to see him return to action. In 1982 in London, Boyer had made the mistake of coming in too light, sacrificing size and density, and he finished out of the money. I saw Boyer in the lobby of his hotel, and he was definitely heavier than 1982, but I couldn't tell what kind of shape he was in. I felt if he approached the fantastic shape he displayed at the 1980 Mr. Olympia or the 1981 Grand Prix in Atlantic City in Montreal, then he'd really give everyone a scare and be competing for the top spots, but this was not to be. Even when Boyer posed one of his usual strong points, some of the co-magic was gone. Today, Boyer had very good color. He could have been darker, and he posed well, but he lacked the usual punch. And he had all his usual strong features, great arms and calves. But with Boyer's structure, he has to be in super shape to do well. That wasn't the case today. He too, like so many of the others, was totally cut and hard, but not ripped. His abs were weak, and his waist appeared wide and thick, and his thighs were not in top shape. All of these factors accounted for his low placing. 12th, Tony Pearson from the USA. Sporting a new nose to emphasize his Michael Jackson resemblance and excellent posing to Billie Jean was not enough to get Tony into the top 10. Tony hadn't even qualified for the Mr. Olympia, never having won either an IFBB Mr. Universe or Grand Prix event, but due to his strong showing in several recent contests, he requested special permission to enter the Olympia, and the request was granted. I wonder why Scott Wilson, who had actually won an IFBB Grand Prix event, didn't do the same thing. Pearson was cut and hard, too, but he wasn't his usual ripped self. Under the harsh lights, he seemed a tad soft, especially when relaxed and a little washed out. Even his skin color seemed a little light. His calves were still down, but his abs were very sharp. His vacuum shot was excellent. And, of course, he had the best lat spread in the entire show. When he tensed his thighs, you could see striations, so you knew he was in shape. And 11th, Chris Dickerson, finishing just one place out of the money, must have been especially frustrating for Chris. As a former Mr. Olympia winner, I'm sure he expected to do much better. I'm curious as to why Chris decided to come out of retirement and make a comeback in this contest. When he retired, he went out on top, and he had more to lose than to gain by competing today. In the past, Chris won so often due to his symmetry, his cuts, and his presentation, and the intangible qualities that made him great. His charisma, the winning attitude, professionalism, and experience. But today, a 2-year absence from competition had dulled the intangible qualities, and he was literally overwhelmed by the youth and muscularity of the higher finishers. Still, ever the consummate professional today, Chris presented us with a pleasing physique and a typically fine Dickerson posing routine. I thought his juxtaposition of classical poses with modern breakdance moves especially good, even if his moonwalk was poorly done. A few years ago, he probably would have finished much higher, but today he seemed to get overlooked and lost in the crowd. And only 2 years since he last competed, the judges are demanding a more ripped look and muscular physique. Being 2 years older and out of competition 2 years took its toll, and Chris seemed to be the forgotten man of the contest. Personally, I had him 10th, but any way you look at it, it was a sad day for a former Mr. Olympia. In 10th place, Tom Platz receiving $1,000. Tom was originally given 9th, and then he was, after the show, changed to 10th. I briefly spoke with Tom Platz at the judges' meeting the night before the contest, and I told him he might be the surprise of the contest, as due to his bicep injury, he'd been overlooked. Looking like the cat that swallowed the canary, Tom smiled shyly at me, and he told me I was right. Almost shaking with excitement, Tom replied that, "I can't wait to pose tomorrow," giving weight and substance to the rumor that he was in fantastic shape. Some said he was at his all-time best, and Muscle and Power magazine was picking him to win the Olympia. Thus, I felt, a little sad for Tom today. When he walked on stage, he received a tremendous ovation, but the ovation seemed to die a bit once he started the pose, which had nothing to do with his posing. It was good, for although Tom has excellent color and he was extremely cut and muscular, maybe even ripped, his injured bicep was still down, and his ponderous thighs, as cut and striated as they are, seemed even bigger when I last saw him in London 2 years earlier, and they upset his balance. I don't know why Tom still does squats and other mass leg movements. If I had legs like his, I'd do all different styles of leg extensions and leg curls, and that would be it for thighs, and I'd spend the extra time on doing upper body work. As it is, his legs should be featured in Ripley's Believe It or Not. I should add that Tom was the only one who seemed to really have fun on stage, and he and Sergio were the only ones to show any aggression and fight. In 9th, Bob Birdsong with $1,500. Today, Bob was probably at his all-time best, and he had one of the best bodies in the entire show. He was almost flawless, physically, that is. He had a deep, dark, rich, even tan and fantastic skin tone. His shape and symmetry were beautiful. Great separation, full round muscle bellies, and good size were all qualities he had in abundance. Besides that, he was ripped and hard as steel. Even his usually hard to cut up thighs were striated and cut today. Individually, each of his body parts were superb. Legs, abs, arms, chest, delts, and back. And as a whole package, he had all the qualities to be a top three finisher. But for some reason, Bob lacks charisma and stage presence. And his posing to the music of Ghostbuster was, to be quite honest, pitiful. It made him look oafish, awkward, and clumsy. He tried to dance to the music, a la Beckles or Grant, but he just couldn't pull it off. It was too bad because Bob deserved much better today. 8th place, Sergio Oliva, $2,000. I have more mixed emotions about Sergio placing 8th today than any of the other contestants. As most Muscle Mag readers know, I did a large two-part article on the myth earlier in the year. I've come to feel close to Sergio and his wife, Arlene, and I have much affection for them both. I phoned them every few weeks the last few months before the contest to check on Sergio's condition and to see how he was coming along and to see how Arlene was, who was pregnant. So frankly, when Sergio was called out for 8th, I felt very sad for him. I know how disappointed he was. Personal feelings aside, I had Sergio 5th or 6th. I overheard Ben Weider tell Bob Kennedy he thought Sergio should have been 5th. Physically, it looked to me as if Sergio was holding a little water under his skin. He sweated gallons under the hot lights during the prejudging and thus appeared a little sharper at the night show than at the afternoon's prejudging. Also, his legs were down a bit in size as a knee injury prevented him from training his thighs as he would have liked. But don't get the impression that Sergio was bad or out of shape. Like so many of the others, he was cut and hard, but he didn't have the super cuts and the definition of the top three or four. To his credit, like some of the other black contestants like Glass, Williams, Pearson, and Grant, who failed to tan and were washed out a bit under the lights, Sergio had excellent color. The biggest difference between Sergio and Lee Haney was that Sergio's muscles were large but flat, while Haney seemed full and as to be bursting through his skin. Haney's water was obviously inside his muscles, while Sergio appeared drawn while still holding water under his skin. I thought Sergio posed very well, and I'm sure he surprised a lot of people with his posing. Even Vince Gironda commented that he thought Sergio posed well. Also, Sergio was the most aggressive man on stage, and he seemed to be the only one to want to mix it up. When he hit some most muscular and classic Oliva overhead poses during the prejudging, it almost started a riot. All through the contest, Sergio seemed to be the crowd favorite, and without him in the pose down, it seemed watered down and dull. When it was finally announced that he was 8th, the crowd rose in unison and gave him a long standing ovation as cries of "Sergio, Sergio" rang throughout the room. This brought on the most touching moment of the entire show when Sergio's wife, Arlene, helped by Rick Wayne, passed up their new two-week-old baby boy, Sergio Jr., to Sergio on stage. Holding the baby, Sergio went to the microphone and he told the audience that what he was holding was worth more than any Mr. Olympia title. Sergio said he had no bitterness or gripe with the IFBB, and he wanted to wish the other contestants well. But it didn't matter if he came in eighth or last, he was still the myth. Everyone in the auditorium, including the remaining competitors on stage, gave him a long and loud applause. A true gentleman is Sergio Oliva. I might add here that during the prejudging, each time Sergio was called out for comparisons, he always shook the other two bodybuilders' hands. He was the only one to do so. So in the final analysis, let it be said that Sergio did not disgrace himself, as everyone predicted he would. He wasn't in quite good enough shape to finish in the top three or four, but he was cut and hard, and he possibly should have been in the top six. He gave everyone a big thrill, and he should be proud of his accomplishment. I know I am, and I'm proud of him. Seventh was Bob Paris from the USA with $2,500. This was Bob's first Olympia, and he made quite an impression on both the judges and the fans alike. There had been great expectations of Bob, and he didn't let his fans down as he came in with good cuts, excellent shape and symmetry, good color, and he posed very smoothly and professionally. With his exceptional good looks, symmetry, and clean lines reminiscent of the great Reeves himself, with more seasoning and training, Bob will surely be a top contender for the Olympia in a few more years. Sixth place, Samir Banut from the USA with $3,000. When Samir was called out for sixth place, he almost fell through the floor. I myself was shocked that Samir only got sixth. I thought he'd taken fourth or fifth at the very worst. Before the show, Frank Zane had congratulated Samir backstage on his magnificent condition, and several competitors also apparently shook his hand in what turned out to be a premature congratulation. When Samir walked on stage in round one of the prejudging, he appeared supremely confident, very hard and cut, but he was not super ripped as in the two previous Olympias. Also, he appeared a little light under the harsh lights, and he seemed to hold a small amount of water under skin, and this was enough to spell doom for Banut. I heard that he gained 8 pounds since last year, and it was obviously too much for his structure. But that's not to say Samir was smooth. He was still one of the top physiques in the whole show, and when he tensed, he appeared very muscular indeed, and his symmetry and proportions were near flawless. But in the relaxed position, he wasn't as hard and ripped as McAway, Haney, Wilcox, or Beckles. Samir had set such a high standard when he won the show last year that anything less than his best was not good enough. Personally, I think the judges were a little hard on Samir, and he deserved better. Look out for him next year. Fifth place, Roy Callender from Barbados with $4,000. Probably the biggest surprise in the whole show to me was Roy placing fifth instead ahead of people like Samir, Sergio, Paris, and Birdsong. And it's the only major dispute I had with the judge's decision. To be perfectly honest, I didn't have Big Roy in my top 10. I was very surprised when he kept being called out at the comparisons of the prejudging, and even more shocked when he made the top six. I'd like to know what the judges saw in him that I couldn't see. Today, Roy seemed heavy and smooth, especially in his thighs, which made his small calves even more smaller. In 1981 in Columbus, Ohio, Roy showed up ripped to the bone, and he only got fourth place when everyone agreed that either he or Tom Platt should have won. This was a very bad break for Roy, but today seemed even out as he got equally lucky breaks to finish in the top six. Ironically, Roy did a fantastic choreographed posing routine, the absolute best I've ever seen him pose in four or five occasions. Fourth place went to Albert Beckles from Britain with $6,000. Well, the old man did it again, showing up in New York in a very ripped condition that was enough to earn him a well-deserved fourth. Yes, his calves were still down a bit in size, and he has a few other structural faults, but damn it, when he hits the double bicep pose from the front or back, it's an amazing sight to behold. Al's back was etched in stone, and his arms, abs, and whole upper torso was fantastic. Third place, Joseph Wilcox from Germany, $10,000. Joseph was a solid third today. His size was colossal as ever, but he managed to gain size without sacrificing cuts. I think his biggest improvement came on the legs, which were bigger, but also more cut and muscular and very vascular. To me, Joseph appeared to be the hardest physique in the entire show, especially in the relaxed position, with deep etched in cuts, good color, and unbelievable muscularity and vascularity. For a big man, his abs were especially fantastic. His posing still lacked the energy and beauty of McAway, and his expression was stoic and bland, but it was by no means poor. Next to Haney, Wilcosh impressed me more than anyone in the entire show. Second place went to Muhammad McAway from Canada, $20,000. For the second year in a row, Muhammad had to be satisfied with second, and I know he was devastated by the result. Devastated because if he wasn't at his all-time best, he was very close, and he realistically can't get much better. And if his best wasn't good enough to beat Haney, then why continue to compete? McAway's not the kind of guy who can be satisfied with second, even if it does net him 20 grand. As usual, he presented a superb little package for the judges to ponder. Beautiful shape and classic symmetry, deeply etched cuts and separation, fantastic overall muscularity, beautiful tan and skin tone, artistic posing, a confident fighting spirit, and professionalism second to none. If he wasn't the best physique in the show, he never showed it. First place, Lee Haney from the USA, $50,000. From the moment Lee walked on stage in the afternoon prejudging until the final pose down at night, he looked like the winner to me and virtually everyone else. His monstrous size overwhelmed everybody, fans and judges alike. He was huge all over, hard, ripped, and proportionate. He seemed to dwarf even the other bigger bodybuilders in the show. As I mentioned earlier, his muscles were full, and he seemed to be bursting through his thin black skin. He appeared to be at his best just standing relaxed. His free posing was adequate and will improve with time. People forget that Lee is only 23. His win today could be the start of another Schwarzenegger-like hold on the Olympia trophy. Certainly, it's hard to foresee anyone beating Haney for a long time, being so young. He's only bound to improve more and more as he matures. Gary Bartlett remarked after the show that this was only Lee's second year since turning pro, and he had never seen Lee make a major mistake in competition. He's only going to get smarter and better each year he competes. Who's going to beat that? Well, that wraps up another Olympia. Just a few extra comments. John Bailey commented that the lighting at this Olympia was the worst he'd ever seen at a Mr. Olympia. It made just about everyone look totally washed out. And the lights were so hot that it was actually burning the competitors' feet. They actually had to move the competitors off stage because the bottoms of their feet were burning so badly. You'd think at the Olympia that someone would get the lighting right. All in all, an exciting show. All right, so that was a great article written by Greg Zulak for the March 1985 issue of Muscle Mag International about the 1984 Olympia, which was Lee Haney's first win. A lot of great competitors in that show, as you can hear the different competitors who were in it. A lot of old school bodybuilders like Boyer Coe and Chris Dickerson. Albert Beckles was probably right at his best right there coming out. He took second place the next year to Lee Haney in the 1985 Olympia. And, of course, the late Joseph Wilcosh was in third place. So that's it for the show this week. We will see you guys next week. Thanks again to Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. See you next week.